Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Sign up and trade DVDs online at filmspotting.net, and also by Honda Fit. The all-new Honda Fit is small on the outside, yet roomy and versatile on the inside. Check it out at fit.honda.com. From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And filling in for Sam Hallgren, I'm Scott Smith. Coming up on the show, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Keith Jenkins and the Moving Parts, and our top five religious movies. But first, witness the 13th biggest opening weekend in human history, The Da Vinci Code.
This is a symbol for Venus. It represents the female half of all things.
You are telling me that Sonia's last act on Earth was to draw goddess symbol on his chest. Why?
Captain Fash, obviously I can't tell you why.
In his phenomenally successful and controversial book, The Da Vinci Code, author Dan Brown neatly describes his protagonist, Harvard symbologist Robert Langdon, as Harrison Ford in Harris Tweed. Of course, Harrison Ford is not the star of director Ron Howard's big screen adaptation. Tom Hanks, who we just heard haggling over murder scene semantics with Jean Renault at the Louvre Museum, is. But Hanks's Langdon does share some similarities with Ford's Indiana Jones. Both are professors, both get caught up in quests seeking out religious artifacts and knowledge, and both, well, okay, maybe they aren't that similar. Indiana Jones is a badass, while the bookish Langdon couldn't crack a whip if he was stuck in a Devo video. His impressive intellect aside, Langdon is basically an average guy, dragged into a dangerous 2,000-year-old mystery shrouding the humanity of Jesus that one character in the movie describes as a secret so powerful it would devastate the very foundations of mankind if it were ever revealed. And who better to cast in this everyman role than the ultimate everyman, Hanks? A little goofy, humble, self-deprecating. Here's how Hanks summed up the challenge of adapting a beloved book on a recent episode of Inside the Actors Studio. When it's done well, it's Gone with the Wind. When it's done badly, it's Bonfire of the Vanities. And I was in Bonfire of the Vanities. Scott, The Da Vinci Code cannot claim the critical pedigree that both Bonfire and Gone with the Wind have. The latter won the Pulitzer Prize in 1937, but Hanks's analogy is as good a place to start as any. Did you uncover the word classic scrambled somewhere in The Da Vinci Code, or the word debacle?
I think the film is hobbled by the book and the fact that it's got such a built-in audience already. And rather than try to do something that matches the medium of film, they basically tried to just put the book on screen as much as possible with all of the book's flaws and some of the book's pacing, which I think the pacing is one of the things that people have enjoyed most about the book in terms of that being, you know, a page turner and a cliffhanger at the end of every chapter. And so I think the movie retains some of that in terms of how it moves from scene to scene, but it also unfortunately retains all of the book's shortcomings in that there are these incredibly large sections of exposition. And here, let me tell you the entire history of Jesus and Mary and all these other things that don't work as well in a film. And the other interesting thing I noted about the film is that it not only has these great expanses of, you know, really boring dialogue where they explain everything, but it also doesn't explain some things enough, like who are these characters and why might they have these certain interactions with each other? What are the backgrounds of these characters? You know, the Jean Renault's character is just thrown right into the beginning of the film, and you don't get the sense of menace that you do, I think, from the introductory paragraphs of the book for his character. So while it over-explained many things, it under-explained things that I, as a film goer, am interested in, the characters and their relationships, and I think the things that make a film like this really strong.
Yeah, I agree with you. I thought there were a lot of problems with this film, and I guess that is the general critical reaction. I'd love to tell the world that all the critics are wrong on this one, but I have to say, I just found this movie mind-numbingly dull.
Yeah.
I was sitting there for the whole film, and never once did I have a moment of real wonder or amazement at anything. And I made the reference in the intro to Indiana Jones, and you can't help but kind of make that comparison, even though they're obviously wildly different, different characters and stories. Raiders of the Lost Ark, this is not, and clearly that's not what Ron Howard is trying to do. But at the same time, it's not even the action scene so much of a movie like Raiders of the Lost Ark, mm-hmm. or the last one in that series where they're looking for the Holy Grail.
Right.
It's not even the action scenes that are really what make me long for something that was missing in the Da Vinci Code. It's mm-hmm. just that sense of wonder, of discovery, of really mm-hmm. feeling like you're learning something.
Right.
I never had that sense of amazement, like I really was learning something interesting the entire time I watched mm-hmm. this film. And other than a moment where there are two sort of traditional stalker movie almost moments where Silas, the bad guy, Paul Bettany, the mm-hmm. killer who's on the loose, jumps out and surprises the characters, mm-hmm. and he surprises you in the audience. You can't help but jump a little bit.
Yeah.
Other than that, I don't remember reacting at all to this film. And I can't mm-hmm. think of a big Hollywood movie I've had a reaction like that, where I just literally sat there bored for most of the film. And I think you're right that a big part of it is, while it goes on way too long explaining some things, there are things that are left out or even completely unnecessary. Mm-hmm. There's a moment where they discover something is written on the Mona Lisa, and they go over to it. And as they're walking, he's talking about the Mona Lisa. He's talking about how mm-hmm. she's framed, how she's sitting a certain way, and what it all means. And it could be interesting, except then Audrey Tautou's character, this French cryptologist, mm-hmm. discovers there's blood on the floor, and then they read what's on the Mona Lisa. It turns out that everything he just got done explaining to us actually meant nothing. Mm-hmm. Like, it actually had no bearing on right. them finding out anything to propel the case forward. It was right. just an example, and there are these moments in the book, too, what I have, mm-hmm. I have read of it. There are moments just like that where it's like there's information for the sake of information.
Right. It's kind of like Dan Brown was trying to show off how much research he had done.
Right.
And they wanted to insert these passages in the film about, okay, this is really a smart, interesting thing we can put in the film to make it seem literate. And it just kind of fails because that information just sort of lies there and it just gets shoved in there. And there isn't that, you know, thing that propels you along. It's a movie about a puzzle, but you never get the sense that you're unlocking interesting things either about the characters or about the way the film unfolds or about the plot. There's never, like you said, that sense of wonderment. You're not cracking things yourself.
No.
You're just sort of watching things happen and not being swept along mm-hmm. and not necessarily, I think, looking forward to what happens next. It's just like, okay, and then they're going to go to this other place, and they're going to find out something else in roughly 3 to 4 minutes, and then they're going to go someplace else.
Yeah, and they'll escape, yeah. and the escapes are all pretty ridiculous in mm-hmm. this film. And you're right, it's true that there are just moments in this film, too, where they're so unintentionally funny. And I guess, mm-hmm. you know, we've heard some of the reports maybe about at Cannes, they were kind of laughing at the film. And unfortunately, there are moments that yeah. are like that. There are just moments that make no sense and are so ridiculous. There's actually a line where maybe the biggest reaction I had, other than being scared by Silas at one point, was Tom Hanks discovers who the real bad guy is of the film. Mm-hmm. We get to the end of the film and find out who's kind of pulling all the strings and all this. Mm-hmm. And when he finds that out, his reaction is to say the character's name. And I'm not going to say it because I would give something away if you mm-hmm. don't, if you haven't read the book yet or seen the movie.
Right.
But the way he says his name and just the fact that he says his name, it's like a parent scolding a child for spilling mm-hmm. the
yeah.
milk.
Yeah.
And this is happening at a moment where everything should be crystallizing. He should be figuring out everything. He's smart enough to put all the pieces together. Mm-hmm. And someone he's trusted is now proving to be
yeah.
a real bad guy, a real evil person. And his reaction is just like, again, it's like he's talking to his child, and mm-hmm. it's funny. I mean, it's just hysterically yeah. funny. And unfortunately, there are a lot of scenes like that. And I just feel like, too, you've got Tom Hanks in this movie, who I think is a great actor. I think is the ultimate sure. everyman actor. Yeah. And unfortunately, I don't know whether it's completely, you know, I think he's hampered by the fact that you've got some dull direction here. Mm-hmm. You've got a dull screenplay. And right. then you've got maybe some dull, you know, co-actors, unfortunately, in a lot mm-hmm. of situations, too. There are a few performances that I think do work, and I'm sure we'll get into those. But he's not good in this film, though.
No.
And it's not an interesting character. It's just simply not an yeah. interesting character, so I don't know that he has much to work with. There's not much to chew on. Mm-hmm. But there is a scene in the book, and I'll just say, I was on vacation last week. I was mm-hmm. in Mexico for a week relaxing. I brought the Da Vinci Code because I knew we were going to review it, and I thought, well, maybe I should read it, sure. like most of our listeners have.
Right.
And I got 110 pages into it, and I realized that I could totally finish this. I've mm-hmm. got 4 or 5 days left on my trip. There's no problem with me finishing this book. And I just decided that even though I was enjoying it somewhat, mm-hmm. there are problems with it. There, unfortunately, absolutely. Again, what most people are saying about it is true. Mm-hmm. But I realized that, you know, I could get through it, and I kind of wanted to finish reading it. And then I said, you know what? I don't want to watch the movie with that mm-hmm. perspective in mind. Mm-hmm. I want to watch the movie completely fresh. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to watch the movie without having the book to completely reference. But for the stuff that I did have a reference point for, there's a moment earlier in the film where Tom Hanks Langdon has to make a decision to flee, mm-hmm. where he learns that actually he's suspected of this murder, mm-hmm. and he is going to run from the cops. And in the book, there's a real interesting conflict there where she really has to, Audrey Tautou, really has to convince him that mm-hmm. he's in danger mm-hmm. and that he does need to do this. He needs to leave. He needs to escape even though he's not guilty, no matter mm-hmm. how bad it looks. That's what he has to do. And it's a really interesting conflict. And mm-hmm. you totally understand that if you were in that exact same situation, you'd want to just go out and say, look, I didn't do this, obviously. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, she's convincing enough that right. he has to do it. In the movie, there's never that moment of conflict at all. He pretty much just listens to her. And at first, he's kind of like, oh, you know, I'm not guilty. Mm-hmm. But then she talks a little bit more, and he's like, okay. And he goes. And mm-hmm. there are things like that where the book, of course, you know, having the space to do it, maybe, but you get some more interesting insight into the characters and sure. some real struggle and conflict. And the mm-hmm. movie doesn't have any of those moments.
And it seems like it just continues to include, you know, swaths of dialogue from History Channel specials mm-hmm. or something like that, where it's just like there's a little bit of character thing and then just this informational passages.
Yeah.
One of the very few things that I enjoyed about the film was this scene near the end. There's two characters and they're discussing sort of what this all means. The fact that there's this huge secret that could completely, you know, if you want to go ahead and believe that all mankind would crumble if this mm-hmm. secret were to be put out there. And Tom Hanks's character is talking to this other character and says, you know, it matters only what you believe.
Uh-huh.
And I went back and I didn't finish the book. And I went back and looked for that scene. It's not in the book. And it's a nice little innovation because it seems to be an answer to the people who are protesting this right. film and have a problem with what the film says. Mm-hmm. And it says basically that faith should be strong enough to get past what maybe someone else says or what a movie says or what someone else kind of considers about your faith or your religion or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I thought that was actually I actually really enjoyed that mm-hmm. that moment. And I thought if only the film had more moments like this, where two characters were having an intellectual discussion mm-hmm. about what does this mean for the world? What does this mean for me personally?
Yeah.
And not just let's try to include all this crazy, wild stuff that might be true and ooh, what if it is, along with all this sort of like historical fiction yeah. type stuff. That was boring. And I thought, for people who have already read the book, why do you want to see that again? Mm-hmm. Why not take the themes and the interest and the puzzles of the book and build on that mm-hmm. and have these moments between characters that maybe aren't in the book but are still true to the spirit of the book. And I felt like that little scene of dialogue really truly is.
Yeah, that is a good point. I like that part as well. And going back to some of those scenes that are supposed to be these intellectually challenging discussions, unfortunately, they're so poorly written. There is this long scene where we meet Ian McKellen, who's this expert on the secret society, mm-hmm. which I did think is kind of funny that the secret that is supposedly going to cause all mankind to crumble, he knows all of it.
Yeah.
And so you figure if he's a scholar and he knows all of it, then it doesn't seem to be that big of a secret if
yeah.
you could actually find out all of this information.
You'd think he'd probably publish it at some point in time.
He knows all the details, so mm-hmm. how big of a secret is it,
yeah.
really? But unfortunately, if you watch that scene where Hanks and Ian McKellen are trying to convince Sophie mm-hmm. of what's going on, and they're having this supposedly spirited intellectual debate, unfortunately, there isn't a moment during it that rings true. Mm-hmm. Not one.
No.
All of Hanks's reactions to what Ian McKellen are saying, it's literally like the screenwriter, Akiva Goldsman, tried to put on the page his idea of what two really smart intellectuals, mm-hmm. how they would argue and how they would talk. Because
right.
I don't know how they would talk, but I know it wouldn't be like that. There's just something so unnatural and so forced about everything Tom Hanks says in that. And unfortunately, the only thing that really saves the movie at all, and especially that part, is Ian McKellen so fun to watch.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Just chewing
the best thing about the film.
Yeah.
He absolutely is. And it's a bit over the top. But again, when you don't have anything else that's really kind of, you know, sending your skirt up a
yeah.
bit, you know, that's you kind of cling to whatever you have. And Ian McKellen certainly kind of delivers that.
I think, honestly, it's a case where he probably knows on some level mm-hmm. that the material is not working.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch that scene, he's the only one of the three having fun, mm-hmm. and he's the only one who's acting well at all, who's interesting mm-hmm. to look at. And,
right.
and as I said, having a good time. It's like he understands the material mm-hmm. and he's going with it and he's playing around with it a little bit. And I think being in that room with the solemn Tom Hanks. And I hate when Tom Hanks, unfortunately, he did it in Road to Perdition. Mm-hmm. Whenever he tries to play a really serious character, he completely loses his sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And he becomes so solemn and wooden that he's no fun to watch at all. And I'm not saying that I want Tom Hanks to always play the same type of character. Mm-hmm. If you look at his body of work, he plays all sorts of different types of characters, but still has a certain wit about him that makes him interesting. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of that to his real life persona as well, his kind of charm, the self-deprecation, and his humor. And it's just not there at any moment in this role. And maybe Ian McKellen was just like, okay, well, if you guys are going to be this stiff, I'm going to at least have a good time. Mm-hmm. I also did think, actually, that I did like Paul Bettany, who's an actor I like a lot. And he plays Silas, this albino monk who's on the run. And he gave me, anyway, the only kind of emotional reaction I ever had to the film. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to the end and you realize this roller coaster he's been on and the strings that have been pulled and why he's doing what he's doing and how he's compromising his own beliefs and his integrity, and then that reaction to find out it was all for naught.
Yeah.
By the time you get there, you actually, I mean, this is the guy who's the bad guy, the monster in the film, and yet he's the only one that you actually have really any sympathy for. I thought that was pretty amazing. I don't know if I give the credit to Goldsman or Howard or just to Paul Bettany for adding some weight to the character.
I think that's Bettany all over. I really, really dislike Akiva Goldsman and have ever since I had to sit through a screening of Lost in Space.
Okay.
So he will always be on my list of people that I just have a personal dislike of. And he, you know, hasn't really impressed me since. And I know he did A Beautiful Mind, and I'm pretty sure he won the Oscar for that.
I think
if
he did.
Recall correctly, which angered me greatly. But this, again, just kind of returned to, this is the Akiva Goldsman I know.
Yeah.
Somebody who just sort of hacks it out and doesn't provide anything interesting and doesn't provide these sort of flashes to the point where that scene that I referenced earlier, I thought, well, I wonder if they brought in a script doctor for that, because I really like that, and it couldn't possibly have been him. Yeah.
And that may be the case. And the other thing I will say, and again, you talked about maybe getting too much information sometimes and not enough otherwise. If you go to the Da Vinci Code website, if you go to different places that are promoting it, they keep talking about the Da Vinci Code as if they're finding out their clues and being pushed forward by Da Vinci's paintings.
Right.
And other than a moment early on with the Mona Lisa, and they go look at another Madonna on the Rocks, and then later, of course, they look at the Last Supper. Other than that, though, I didn't even learn anything about Da Vinci watching the film.
No.
I didn't learn anything about his artwork, about the significance of it. I mean, it's just sort of passed over and glossed over. And again, I didn't finish the book, so maybe it's there. I'm sure it's there in much more detail, probably in painstaking detail. But at the same time, I'm like, how do I watch this movie where all the clues are supposed to be embedded in the artwork and the symbology of it? And not come away with having any more knowledge really about Da Vinci going in than I had, you know, coming out. It just didn't make any sense.
And people would always talk about how complex the film or the book was and all these puzzles to find, but I never really got that. Like, for instance, there's that one scene, I think it's the same scene you were talking about earlier, where it's Ian McKellen, Hanks, and Audrey Tautou, and they're sitting around, and at one point, she needs the concept of the Holy Grail explained to her.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, how is that possible? First of all, it just doesn't make any sense to me that somebody at this point is going to need that just basic concept.
Right.
You understand, obviously, the movie takes it much further and challenges, you know, that idea of what the Holy Grail is and all, but the very original concept, she needs it explained to her?
Yeah.
Well, and that, I don't understand how that the film would even bother with
that. I think a real flaw of the movie, and I don't know if I'm comparing this to the book too much from what I did read, but I think one other flaw I'll mention is that with Sophie's character, she's way too stupid.
Mm-hmm.
In the book,
yes.
They set her up as she's someone who's should be on par with Langdon in terms of her brilliance and her ability to figure things out, and it makes her a much more interesting character.
Mm-hmm.
Here, Audrey Tautou spends the entire film looking confused.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically her job for the whole film, is to look confused and have someone explain something to her, which doesn't mesh at all with her upbringing, what we learned about who she's been taught by and what she's supposed to know, and the role she has in life, what she does as a cryptologist.
Yeah.
She is a brilliant person. You never get that sense watching the film.
Yeah, and she, I think, at one point says something to the effect of not enjoying, what is it, numbers, or was it not enjoying, like, science? There's some, like, academic pursuit that she's like, oh yeah, I never really got into that. And I'm like, how is that possible that you got your job then?
Right.
Like, there was just things about those characters that didn't ring true and that didn't make sense, as if somebody hadn't really thought them out. And I don't know. The other thing that really bothered me is that there weren't maybe enough characters in the film for me, because what ended up happening is you get this sort of Scooby-Doo syndrome where it's really easy to figure out who the bad guys are, because you're like, okay, so it's everybody and that guy. Oh, that guy's probably going to be turn out to be bad.
Exactly.
You know, and that's, again, it was just like, I shouldn't be able to go to cartoons to figure out the plot of this film. It just shouldn't be.
All right, well, if you've seen The Da Vinci Code and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
And after the break, Film Spotting, brought to you by the Church of Scientology. Listener feedback is next. Plus, stick around for your chance to win a free DVD in Massacre Theater. But first, some recent audio feedback.
Hey Adam and Sam, this is Jakeem from Brisbane, Australia. Just finished listening to your top 5 one-timers, and I agree with most of those films. However, there was one omission that I was hoping you'd include. The 1993 Australian cult film classic, Bad Boy Bubby. It's about a child born out of wedlock, locked up in a flat by an abusive mother until the age of 35. Actually, this film is so disturbing, it's so funny, that it qualifies for the top 5 films that make you a sick bastard for enjoying.
Should I go away? Like you asked me. This ordinary time to share is all we have left. I push you every day.
At the same time, I'm fascinated by people who've gone off the deep end, by the people that take it too far. The question is, how does a civilized person exist in a not-so-civilized world?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with guest host Scott Smith. I'm Adam Kempinar. You heard there a clip from director Don Coscarelli discussing his film Incident On and Off, A Mountain Road from the Masters of Horror series. We also heard Jakeem's voicemail about an Australian one-timer called Bad Boy Bubby. We'll get back to both of those in a moment, but first we have to announce this week's PeerFlix DVD winner, and unfortunately PeerFlix having a few technical issues, they were not able to get us the name of the winner in time as we sit here and record, Scott, but we will announce the winner of the Napoleon Dynamite Special Edition on our website as soon as we have it, so check filmspotting.net for that. PeerFlix, of course, is a new way to get DVDs cheap. It's only 99 cents every time you get a DVD in the mail. There are no monthly fees, and over 200,000 DVDs are available on the network. Learn more at filmspotting.net and receive a free DVD when you sign up. Plus, sign up between now and Tuesday, May 30th, and you'll be entered to win the Patton Special Edition. Coppola, I think, has a commentary on this, a making-of documentary. It's out on DVD this week, along with The Dirty Dozen, 2-disc special edition, Harlan County, USA, Criterion Collection. This is Barbara Kopple's documentary. Yeah. It's actually going to be part of our documentaries marathon, 3 marathons down the road here. Kingdom of Heaven, a 4-disc director's cut of Ridley Scott's film.
Wow.
We reviewed it way back on Cinecast number 12. Sam gave it 3 stars. I gave it 2. He liked it more than I did. I went back and listened to some of our review today, and I actually recalled a number of things listening to it that I did like about the film. There are a few things I like, but it's the kind of movie that I think may actually be worth checking out on DVD. Also out this week, Transamerica. We reviewed it on Cinecast number 77. Sam hated it. Mm. I liked it. You can check out that review and check out the movie. And then finally, The Boondock Saints Special Edition. Out on DVD this week, and this came up in our last show, the 100th episode. Sam mentioned, why do people care about this movie? And is it a cult film, he asked. And I said, yes, it is. That's exactly what it is, a cult film. And we received a number of emails from listeners who said, The Boondock Saints is great. You've got to go see it. Have you seen it, Scott?
I saw it actually when I was working at a video store, and there was a guy that worked there who could not say enough good things about the movie.
Yeah.
And there were people when he would leave who could not say enough bad things about the movie. So I think it's one of those you love it or you hate it kind of films, but the people who love it really, really love it.
They do.
And there's absolutely demand for it. It's like there's always a handful of those kind of films that have their audience, and that audience will be milked time and time again with special editions like this.
Yeah, when Sam mentioned that he really didn't even know anything about it, I was surprised, only because when I had a radio show back in college, a film show, we would get calls from people that would mention in top 5 lists, they would mention The Boondock Saints, and they would say how much they love this film. And so I knew that there was this cult following for this film, and I know I'm going to have to break down at some point and watch it. I will do that. Let's get then on to some thank yous. Of course, people who have been so generous as to donate on the filmspotting.net site, clicking on the PayPal link, we would like to thank, and Sam may not be here, but he is here in spirit, and this time I'm not even going to amend his nicknames. He's done a great job. He has tied in nicknames, as he likes to do, with what we're discussing. So think about the Da Vinci Code, and here's who we would like to thank.
Gonzalo, the Apocryphal Mastodon. Shiran, the Sinning Son of St. Petersburg. Sigurdur, Dirty Knees on Sunday. Kevin, Money Changer Trash Can Beating. Ross, Overlooked Bible Hero. Donna, Excised at Nicaea. And a gold member, Daniel, Plague of Cain. And Christopher, Taking a Nap for All You Sinners.
That's right. Thank you to all of you for donating, and we hope you enjoyed Sam's nicknames. I think you did a really good job there. Okay. We also wanted to then mention on the filmspotting.net site our current poll question. Last week's poll question, with the Da Vinci Code coming out, we asked, did you read the Da Vinci Code? And the results pretty much mirrored how they started. The number one answer, of course, you didn't. 51% of the voters said they have definitely read the Da Vinci Code. 25% said no, and they're not excited about the movie. 15% no, but excited about the movie. And only 8% think Dan Brown is the Antichrist. So
I'm sure
he'll be relieved to hear that. This week's poll question, go to filmspotting.net, vote in the poll just put up today. I was having a hard time. I knew I wanted to come up with something X-Men, so I emailed you, Scott, and I said, you got any inspiration, any thoughts? You came up with some great choices. I like this one a lot. Will you see the planned Wolverine X-Men spinoff? They've already got this in the works. Mm-hmm. Hugh Jackman is going to come back as Wolverine, a whole movie based around Wolverine, and the choices are?
Yes, Wolverine is a badass, coming in at about 44% right now. Maybe, who's directing, coming in at 43%, and no, not into comic books, and that's at 12%.
And I voted for yes, Wolverine is a badass. Of course, I'll have to see it because I will probably be reviewing it, but I do like the X-Men series. Mm-hmm. I liked the comic books when I was a kid. Wolverine is a badass.
Yeah.
And I will be curious. Now, I could also see the maybe vote because if it's a director I can't stand, I might be less inclined to want to go see it. But right now, I will go see it. How did you vote?
I would say maybe who's directing. Because there have been so many characters like this that you have spinoffs, and that character is not strong enough to carry the film because of what the director's trying to do, and that there almost seems like they're trying to make it be part of their demo reel for later on.
Yeah.
So I think it's maybe who's directing and what's the script sound like to me. That's usually kind of what I'm going
to
go with.
Yeah, and for these comic book movies to work for me, you need someone who can be considered a visionary type of guy, a guy like Bryan Singer, who's going to bring a perspective and a style to a film like the first two X-Men and to what Superman looks like.
Right.
And so if you hire just some kind of Hollywood hack, which some people, of course, think Brett Ratner is, we'll get into that next week, to do the Wolverine movie, I'm not going to be as excited about it for sure. They need someone with a real style. So we'll see what happens with that. That is supposedly in the works, though. So go to filmspotting.net, vote in that poll. Going back to the Masters of Horror series, of course, this is on Showtime. You can go to mastersofhorror.net and get some more information about it. Last week on our 100th episode, the week before actually, we gave away the first two movies in that Masters of Horror series to our winner, Stephen Carson. You can be entered to win by signing up for The Dope Sheet, our weekly email blast, which you can sign up for at filmspotting.net. And this week's winner of the next two movies in the Masters of Horror series, Don Coscarelli's Incident on and Off a Mountain Road and Chocolate by Mick Garris, who directed The Shining and The Stand on TV. Those are the next two, and the winner of those is Elliot Gerstel, or Elliot Gerstel. Elliot, thank you. Email us, and we'll send out your prize. Send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. We also, Scott, had a voicemail there from Jakame in Australia, who mentioned this film, Bad Boy Bubby, as a one-timer, a movie that's so disturbing he does not want to relive. Have you heard of this film?
I have not.
I haven't either. I mean, that's a rare occasion when you haven't even heard of a film someone's mentioning, but it's this Australian film made a while back. I'm going to take his word for it. I don't know that I'm going to get to it. I don't know that it's going to bust my Netflix queue or my Peerflix queue here anytime soon, but we wanted to play his voicemail. A couple other voicemails we didn't get to. Mark in West Hartford, Connecticut, called in to mention as a one-timer the movie Irreversible. And this is a film I don't know if Sam and I had a chance to get into the one-timers feedback. Again, movies that are kind of so disturbing you don't really want to revisit. But Irreversible came up a lot, including this email from Liam Dur Sarkeesian, who said, "Don't know if you guys have seen it, but check it out. It certainly deserves a place on a list like this. I didn't recognize it purely as mindless shock tactic violence, as many did, but more of a commentary on vengeance, time, cause and effect. It's a must-see if you can stomach it." And Ryan Taylor from Richmond, Virginia wrote in, "I eagerly listened to your top five one-timers list and hoped that this film would be included, but alas, it was omitted. The film is Irreversible, written and directed by French director Gaspar Noé, starring Monica Bellucci and Vincent Cassel. I believe I first heard about this film after it was shown at Cannes and numerous people walked out. It depicts one of the most intensely violent scenes I can remember seeing in film, and I'm a self-proclaimed horror fan, yawning at masterpieces like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. By definition, it is a movie that will stay with me, but I cannot recommend anyone ever see this film. Truly scarring." So,
wow. So
a recommendation and yet not a recommendation,
not so much,
from Ryan there. But they weren't alone. This movie came up a lot. Sam and I have not seen it. I can't say I'm excited to see it now,
right.
but I did. I added it to my queue. I'm going to find the courage at some point, Scott, to check it out. We also had just a nice email from Sam in New York who called to congratulate us on our 100th episode, and we appreciate all those emails that we got and from people who seem to enjoy the kind of look back on the 100th episode. I know, in fact, you were even enjoying, Scott, listening to our musical massacre rendition.
And again, it's like when you talk about one-timers, that's something I don't ever need to hear again,
yeah.
But I really enjoyed it when I heard it. So
that's exactly it. Sam and I singing up where we belong.
Yeah.
It's a one-time thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, let's get to some Mission Impossible feedback, Scott. And this is a film that you did just see recently.
Right.
And so hopefully we'll get your perspective throughout this as well. But the most interesting emails we got about our review were from people who hated it. That was the reference in the tease there to Film Spotting now being brought to you by the Church of Scientology, apparently. So why don't we go ahead, Scott, you can kick it off. This email from Yvonne Rabone in Birmingham, UK.
And she says, "Upon seeing you were going to review MI3, I gleefully anticipated your attack of the film, which never came. What's going on? Are you two in the pay of a shadowy Scientology puppet master? Do you believe that J.J. Abrams can do no wrong based solely on his TV work? Are you deliberately going against a lot of the critics who have fallen into the 'let's attack Tom Cruise' trap? If so, this does not excuse you. Don't get me wrong. I still love you guys and respect your opinions, and Philip Seymour Hoffman is great in this film, the best thing in it by a long way. But I was just so surprised to hear you being so complimentary about such a shallow movie. Haven't we all seen the tired, oh, let's kidnap the spouse, girlfriend, significant other of the hero gambit so many times before? Haven't we all seen Tom Cruise doing his over-emotional Tom Cruise-style acting too many times before? And how many shots of Tom Cruise running in one film do you really need?"
Well, that is a good point, and she is right about a few of those things that she brings up. It's true, Tom Cruise acts the same in every movie, and sure, we've seen this plot before, especially, I guess, if you watch Alias, as we'll get into with some of these other emails from listeners, but, you know, okay, so it's a shallow movie. You know what? Even film critics like to go to the movies and have a good time every now and again, and as far as a popcorn movie goes, this is a pretty damn good one.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who, when you criticize a film that's clearly made for a mass audience and it's clearly made just to be enjoyed and just be experienced and just kind of have fun at the movies, if you criticize a film like that, people say, well, you know, it's just a popcorn movie. It's just a good time movie.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you say, no, it can be done better. And I really think this movie does it better. It starts it off in a way that challenges you as a viewer and then kind of walks you back through that. There are incredibly great performances in the film. I think you guys mentioned you wanted to see more of Carrie Russell, as did I was a huge Felicity fan. I'm man enough to admit it. And there was a lot going on that was great and really raised the bar, I think, for this type of a film. I really came out of this movie thinking that you are not going to be able to go back and just make a crap action film again and have it be like, oh, well, it's just an enjoyable action film. No, it can be done better. And I thought this was an example of that. And if that makes me wrong, then I don't want to be right.
Well, I appreciate the support. Sam and I appreciate it because we definitely didn't get it much from a number of our listeners, including this one, Dave Trammell. "I just listened to your review of MI3, and I can't help but wonder if we were actually watching the same movie. Yes, Philip Seymour Hoffman was the star of the movie. He stole the show and played the ultimate bad guy. I wanted more Carrie Russell. Her role was all too short. I was really looking forward to seeing MI3, mostly because of J.J. Abrams. I've been a big fan of Alias since the beginning. With that, how could Abrams not succeed in making an MI movie that was nonstop action and thrills from beginning to end? The main problem is that through the entire film, I felt like I was watching Alias the movie without any of the characters that I know and love. Putting family members in danger, having the main character retrieve the impossible to retrieve device, almost killing said family member in front of the main character, all of these things are used as regular plot devices on Alias." And this is something that did come up a lot in emails, and I guess it's to our advantage Sam and I anyway, that we haven't seen Alias. Mm-hmm. We don't watch Lost. I have a select number of TV shows I find the time for every mm-hmm. week. And unfortunately, and after seeing MI3, I'm more curious to see what he's done on TV. But I haven't had time for Alias or Lost. Maybe that was a good thing because I wasn't constantly comparing it. I'm sure there are a number of comparisons to Alias. Maybe I wouldn't have enjoyed the movie as much if I was a regular of that show.
I watch Alias pretty regularly, and while it's certainly kind of gone down the tubes as of late, which is pretty much par for the course for J.J. Abrams shows, when he gets involved in other projects, the shows kind of seem to suffer a bit. And there are similarities in terms of the way the characters interact personally. And that's, I think, one of the hallmarks of his work mm-hmm. is to tell the backstories of these characters and get involved with what makes them tick and where are their emotional pressure points and what makes these characters fail in some ways and go against their own good nature in some ways.
Yeah.
And you see that on Lost and you see that on Alias, certainly. And that's what made this film interesting for me. And while that was, I kind of got that. I kind of said, oh, yeah, he's kind of doing a variation on a theme
right.
here. But I didn't think, oh, I've seen that in Alias
yeah.
before. I never felt that way. But.
Well, I mean, if you talk about the best directors we think of, auteurs, they're auteurs because you can find the common threads in their
mm-hmm.
work. And I'm not saying that J.J. Abrams is on par with an Ingmar Bergman yet
mm-hmm.
or something like that, obviously, or even a Woody Allen or a Spike Lee. But these are all filmmakers who have certain threads, whether
mm-hmm.
it's visual things or thematic or character type devices that you see again and again, because those are obviously the issues that fascinate them. And
right.
I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that you
mm-hmm.
see those common threads in his
sure.
work so far. So let's get then to the last email here on Mission Impossible. Go ahead, Scott.
And this is from Samuel Axon, I believe the pronunciation is, from Springfield, Missouri. What caught my attention was your question as to what Tom Cruise might be like later in his career, as the charismatic young male lead thing becomes less and less acceptable. I agree he's not going to be hemming it up in a Shakespeare adaptation anytime soon, but did you guys see Collateral? It was quite a departure for him, and I thought he performed very well. I often find myself defending this film against those who insist that it sucks, but I thought Collateral was fantastic, even if the central coincidence was somewhat contrived. Tom Cruise, I thought, was excellent. I completely bought him. What did you guys think of him in Collateral, and do you think he could go to that role in the future? Hell, he even had gray hair.
He did have gray hair, and as some listeners will remember, Sam chastised me back on our top five overrated list. I actually put Collateral in there, and he chastised
mm.
me, not because he loves the film, but because it just wasn't a very daring pick. I mean, and he's probably right, but a lot of critics really loved Collateral, and
mm-hmm.
even though I like Michael Mann, the movie didn't do much for me at all. And we also got an email from a voicemail from Mark in Atlanta, who called in referencing my comment during the 100th episode that you won't see Tom Cruise doing King Lear anytime soon. And he took me figuratively as if I was somehow impugning Cruise's dramatic skills, when I was meaning literally,
mm-hmm.
you're just never going to see Tom. He's an action movie star.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that he wouldn't try the role. It's that action movie stars don't play King Lear. People like Philip Seymour Hoffman play King
sure,
Lear.
Sure.
You don't see, and you know, Mel Gibson can play Hamlet because that's a showy kind
mm-hmm.
of role, but King Lear is for an old man. There are certain people who can pull
sure.
it off. Tom Cruise never will. Again, that's not a knock against him. I was
mm-hmm.
just saying it as a point of fact, but they're right. I think Tom Cruise is a fine actor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I use fine loosely. I think he's fine. I think he was fine in Collateral. I actually think he's better in that movie than Jamie Foxx, who everyone loves
yeah.
in it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. What was your take?
I'll only say this. Bruce Willis was a guy who everyone thought would only play boyish, kind of showy, kind
mm-hmm.
of smarmy, smirky kind
yeah.
of parts. And he's turned into quite the fine actor.
That's true.
And somebody capable of some pretty heavy dramatic parts. Not a guy I'm going to see playing King Lear.
No.
But a guy that I'm certainly going to be interested in if he's playing a dramatic role. And maybe Tom Cruise will get to that point in the
maybe
future
he will.
As well.
Maybe he has to lose his hair.
That could be it.
Maybe that's it.
Bald but Tom Cruise.
Bald
People
Tom
will pay
Cruise,
good money for that.
Yeah, they would go see him maybe try a Lear-type role. Maybe
mm-hmm.
he just needs to lose his hair. We'll see. All right, well, we got a number of great emails as well about our top five performances list with our special guests, Scott Ferguson and Dylan Kidd. We're going to get back to those next week when Sam rejoins us. So listen to Film Spotting 102 and 103. We'll get into those top five lists. And if you've got feedback for us, send us an email or short MP3 clip to feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-CINNA, 206-203-2463. We'd love to hear from you.
That's all he ever wanted out of life, was love. That's the tragedy of Charles Foster Kane. Another round of Massacre Theater, including this week's winner. And our top five religious movies are up next. Stay with us.
Before the days we worked so hard, torn out pages, light the fire and watch them burn the whole place down. Please, Susan. From now on, everything will be exactly the way you want it to be. Not the way I think you want it, but your way.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Time now for Massacre Theater. Last week, we massacred the scene you just heard from Orson Welles' all-time Pantheon great, Citizen Kane, a special pick for our special 100th episode. Scott, go ahead and reach into the Film Spotting hat. It's not the Cinecast hat like Sam wanted, I'm sorry. And pick out this week's winner.
Okay. And the winner is Peter Labuza from St. Paul, Minnesota. Congratulations, Peter. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with a DVD of your choice.
All right, good job there, Peter. Let's get to this week's Massacre Theater, tying in, as it usually does, with the movie we're reviewing and our top five theme, religious movies. That's all we're going to say about it for now, religious movies. And I believe that you start out the scene, Scott, so I'm going to give you the action. And action.
What about last spring break at the Promise Makers rally?
You were making accusations as we're trying to save your soul. Turn away from Satan. Jesus, he loves you.
You don't know the first thing about love.
I am filled with Christ's love. You were just jealous of my success in the Lord.
This is not a weapon, you idiot. What, did they send you to strap me on the back of your scooter?
Scooter? This is a Vespa?
And scene.
All right, if you know what film Scott and I just massacred, send us an email by Tuesday, May 30th to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced next week. And I liked your cattiness there, Scott.
Thank you.
Well done. Okay.
Felt good.
Top five religious movies. And I'm curious kind of what you used as your criteria here. Obviously, these could be movies that deal specifically with a religion or movies that just have themes that tie in with some religious themes.
Sure.
What did you do, Scott?
I ended up going really towards movies that dealt very specifically with religion or very specifically with faith. And I had a couple movies that did have sort of religious overtones to them or even spiritual overtones to them. But when I came right down to it, the movies that I picked ended up being very personal for me, which is sort of how I kind of view religion and faith.
It's
something that's really, really personal and almost, in a lot of ways, hard to talk about with other people. And that's just kind of how my top five ended up as well.
I am intrigued. What is your number five?
My number five is a movie that is, I know you guys talk a lot about nostalgia picks, and I think this is one of them, and I think it might even be one if I went back and looked at it, I wouldn't enjoy as much. Little Buddha from 1993.
Keanu.
Starring Keanu, and these sort of interesting flashback sequences where, talk about a movie that tells you things about historical perspective on religion and on religious figures, but does it in a way that's not haughty, or and just lets it unfold and really lets it be a part of the film. The reason why this movie is actually, not just because of the nature of the film and the subjects it discusses, which were really new to me, I saw this just as I was finishing up high school, and this was one of the first art films, if you will, that I saw. You know, can you call a movie with Keanu in it an art film?
Yeah.
I think so. But this was, I would see this at the Park Forest Theater, and that was like the one place near me where you could see these kind of films, and it really started to open up this idea about what film could be and how you could have these kind of issues explored in a film, and that there was more than just action films and silly comedies and things like that. So it really had an impact on me, and that's part of why I chose it.
Great. I think it's a great choice. I considered it as well. It's a movie I like too. My number five is one I'll probably take some grief for, but I don't care at all. I'm an unabashed fan of this movie and of this soundtrack, and it's come up before once or twice on the show, and that is Jesus Christ Superstar, the 1973 film directed by Norman Jewison. And it was funny because I read today on Amazon.com their description of it. They say, Ted Neely makes for a wimpy-looking Jesus in Norman Jewison's screen adaptation of the Andrew Lloyd Webber, Tim Rice rock opera. And I was thinking to myself, I guess I never thought of Jesus as being someone who had to be well-built and really muscular. But reading the line, too, it occurred to me that, you know, for whatever he lacks in physicality, he makes up for with his pipes. Ted Neely is an amazing singer, and the music in this film, and it is a rock opera, there's nothing said, it's all sung, and you've got Ted Neely, brilliant as Jesus, and Carl Anderson, maybe even more brilliant as Judas, and of course, the magic, really, I guess, of Jesus Christ Superstar is that it's told from, it's the story of Jesus in his last 6 days from Judas's perspective, which isn't a perspective we get very often, and it's really fascinating. This is the kind of thing where I have friends from college that we actually, and again, we don't listen to any other Andrew Lloyd Webber, but we will put this in our CD player and just listen to this soundtrack. And the movie is really interesting too, because it's totally anachronistic, shot in 1973, yeah. And it's shot on location in Israel, and you've got all these high-tech weapons and, like, jet fighters flying over, and they arrive on a bus. There's this kind of hippie feel to it right. That just kind of makes it fun.
Mm-hmm.
And, I, like I said, it's a soundtrack I love and a movie I enjoy, too.
Yeah, I would support that. My number four is, I think, one that you would sort of expect to show up on a movie of top five religious movies, The Ten Commandments, 1956, starring Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner. And I got to say, I think I have a soft spot for Heston in these larger-than-life uh-huh. roles. I think there are a few people that do it better. But really, one of the things that caused me to pick this is before these event films of the 1970s with these huge set pieces in it, this was a film that really had that. And so this was one of these first huge, big movies yeah. that really sort of expanded the idea of what film could do. And this was, again, this is sort of late 1950s at this point.
Yeah, DeMille.
I saw this in a religion class. I went to a Catholic high school for 4 years. And my religion teacher set it up and said, you know, this is going to be, you're going to think it's a little hokey. Some of the special effects are kind of cheesy. I remember seeing it and going, you know what, that kind of holds up. He yeah. drops a staff, turns into a snake. Uh-huh. That was cool.
Yeah,
I would
not
see
bad.
That.
You're right.
Yeah. And one thing I found that was really interesting was, you know, I was seeing this in a Catholic school, and so these stories seem to have a very Catholic bent to them for me. DeMille's Episcopalian.
Yeah.
And so I thought it brought just a little bit of something interesting, you know, a different perspective. You would expect him to be like a very staunch Catholic maybe or something like that. But, you know, he was kind of telling a story, I guess, from a different perspective. And it's, you know, it's a really good movie for me and, you know, a movie that's as good as the book,
yeah,
I guess you'd say.
It's interesting because I saw The Ten Commandments fairly recently when I finishing up my master's degree. Mm-hmm. I took a Bible in film class, and we got way into The Ten Commandments. And it's interesting because it's one of these rare cases where this 1950s movie where DeMille actually comes out at the beginning of the film and addresses you as an audience member.
Yeah.
He actually walks out from behind a curtain. It's very theatrical and talks to you and says what his goal is with this film. Mm-hmm. And he seems to be making this very pro-faith, pro-religion type of movie, but if you do get into it deeper, there are some interesting little ways he subverts a lot of the messages that come through, and especially the way he handles Moses' character. So it is an interesting film, and more than just being the spectacle film that it is.
And if you have Edward G. Robinson in a biblical epic...
Where's your Moses now?
Where's your Moses now, see? Where's your Moses now?
Yeah, I mean, it's perfect just for that.
Glory.
I agree. My number four probably won't be a surprise to regular listeners of the show, but I had to put on Rosemary's Baby.
Mm.
Polanski, 1968. It was his first American feature, and Ruth Gordon, who Sam put on his best performances comedic, you know, for Harold and Maude. I considered her for Harold and Maude and as Minnie Castevet in this movie, Rosemary's Baby. It's almost a comedic performance in a movie that isn't funny at all, but she's great. And you've got a scene in the movie where Mia Farrow actually looks at the copy of Time magazine in the dentist's office or at the doctor's office, and it says, "Is God dead?" And that's an actual cover article from 1966. And then, of course, we get it later in the film. We get Roman Castevet, Minnie's husband, saying, "God is dead. Satan lives. The year is won. The year is won." And there's the Hail Satan. It's hilarious watching all these older women say Hail Satan. They look like they should be at a tea party or something. And he says, "Why don't you help us out, Rosemary?" He says to her about the child, the son of the devil. Mm-hmm. And the last time you were here, actually, we did our twist endings, and Rosemary's Baby was on my list there too. Not a film that has a super shocking twist ending in that it makes you rethink the whole movie, but just completely confounds your expectations. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a brilliant film. And it obviously is a film that may not deal explicitly with religion, but when you're getting into these questions of, is God dead, which ultimately the film is asking, then it's going to make my
list. It's definitely a counterculture film, and that it really just sort of, you know, like a lot of the films being made at that time, was sort of challenging the ideals of, you know, the previous generation and things like that in a very twisted and weird and dark and maybe not so realistic way.
Yeah.
But in what it says underneath, you know, it's got something to say, and it's really interesting for that.
And Mia Farrow is good in it as well. And John Cassavetes, of course, the great filmmaker in an acting performance as her husband. And you've got this modern kind of perspective of the guy who, you know, this is the late 60s, the whole hippie kind of flower power thing is gone. And these people are selling out now. This is a guy who's willing to do you know, amazing things, amazingly terrible things to his wife in order to further his career. And he's really smarmy in the film and really fun to watch. So,
excellent. My number three is another movie that really kind of had a big effect. I mean, that's The Apostle from 1977, starring Robert Duvall. First, a movie that took him, I think, something like 10 years to get made. It was a pet project of his that he just continued to hold on to and really had to wait until he got big enough and famous enough where he had the clout to get that film made. But really a film with an extremely flawed anti-hero at its core, and yet a movie that is inspiring in a way and treats religion and faith as redemptive and not as a joke, or doesn't even, I think if this maybe film were to get made now with somebody else in the lead, you know, we'd be seeing these sort of tired cliches about how, you know, religion corrupts and how, you know, religion, you know, makes people evil and mean and violent and what have you, all this sort of stuff that you're, you kind of see nowadays, unfortunately. But it treated religion as a force of redemption.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really powerful message to have in a film and not one that you see very often. So yeah. I loved it for that.
It's a good choice. And I agree that I think one of the things that makes it so good is the way it dances around those issues and makes religion seem like a very real thing,
mm-hmm.
makes faith seem very real. And it doesn't treat it ironically, but it also doesn't completely sentimentalize it or make it seem like something that, well, you either get or you don't, and that's all there is to it. And kind of, it doesn't shut the door on anyone. I think it really asks you to come in. I think it's an interesting film. My number three is The Last Temptation of Christ, a film that ties in really well with The Da Vinci Code, because the big dust-up over this film, the controversy of this film, of course, is that at the end of Jesus' life, we have this hallucination that he has had sex, Jesus, with Mary Magdalene.
Mm-hmm.
She's pregnant with child, and again, it's a hallucination, but nice little tie-in there. And I just think it's a really, obviously it's Scorsese, I think it's really fun to look at.
Mm-hmm.
I like the kind of camera tricks, those Scorsese things that nobody else gives you, the camera movements, especially the movements when he's kind of putting you on the cross with Jesus, and those moments are hard at the end. But the conflicted Jesus and the way Willem Dafoe plays Jesus as a guy who, I haven't seen that portrayal yet, other than Dafoe's, of a guy who really seems like he's discovering who he is at every moment. And it's changing all the time. And when he is telling a story, it's not like Jesus, well, it's Jesus, so he knows what he's saying is incredibly powerful and everyone's going to listen to him. It's really, you get this sense, you're watching him kind of discover the power he has or any charisma he has. And sometimes he doesn't have it. Sometimes he's talking to a group and they turn on him and he sounds like a lunatic. He sounds genuinely like a lunatic. And the fact that he's willing to play both those shades to Jesus, again, I think it's a very unique performance. And, you know, he's not overly charismatic, but it's Willem Dafoe. You can't take your eyes off him. I think it's a really interesting film and maybe a nice companion to The Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, it's definitely a film I want to see again. I haven't seen it since it originally came out. And Da Vinci Code actually made me want to go back and look at that and re-examine it again.
Yeah, and you know, too, one last point is that, of course, it's much more based, as it says right up front, that it's much more based on the Kazantzakis novel than it is the actual Gospels.
Right.
But if you are familiar with the Gospels, and I am, you see, of course, that it isn't that wildly off. Maybe some of the interpretations of things, but you can, if you're familiar with the Gospels, you will find those signposts along the way. So,
and I think my number two, another film that also kind of plays with the story of Jesus, is Kevin Smith's Dogma from 1999, a film that talks about the idea that Jesus had brothers and sisters. And the main character is the Last Scion, this direct relation to Jesus Christ, and the ability to save the world now kind of rests in her hands. And it's an absolute comedy. I mean, there's a rubber poop monster at one point in the film, and it's definitely a movie that you could just sort of dismiss, but at the time, people took it incredibly seriously, and he was getting death threats to the point where he was like, you know, they were stocking up on bulletproof vests and things like that. But, you know, this is another movie that sort of, like Last Temptation of Christ, that challenges your preconceived notions about what religion is and what faith is and, you know, who this Jesus person is, and how he can still, regardless, be this sort of force for inspiration for people. And really, what do you do when everything you know about yourself turns out to be wrong? And how do you react to that?
Yeah.
And what do you do? And how do you continue to live your life in a way that is still satisfying to you? And I, you know, do you get that out of a movie with a rubber poop monster? For me, I did.
Yeah.
And it was just really interesting to watch her character go through that and experience that. And it's, you know, it was inspiring for that reason.
Yeah, it's actually a film, a Kevin Smith film, I didn't like much when I saw it. And I think it's something I need to go back and see. The funniest part of that, though, you mentioned the picketing. I mean, I remember seeing pictures of Kevin Smith out with picket signs with the picketers, and the fact that they didn't know who he was is just brilliantly funny. My number two might be a bit of a surprise to some people, but it's another film that's come up on the show before as kind of a pantheon film for me. May need to go into the penalty box soon, but it's actually Cool Hand Luke.
Wow.
1967, Paul Newman. There are actually too many biblical analogies and references to count in this movie. I mean, literally just direct kind of interpretations from the Bible put in this setting imposed upon this southern prison setting.
Mm-hmm.
And you've obviously got Luke as a Christ figure, and you've got Dragline as Judas, who does betray him at the end, just as Judas does, tells the police where they can come find him. And you've got this moment at the end with Luke where he's in an abandoned church and he's talking, where he's talking to God like Jesus in the garden, questioning, you know, why does this have to happen? What, you know, why do I have to be sacrificed? And that's kind of what he's saying to God in that scene. And you know, this whole concept of original sin, too, is what permeates this film. And I'll just close out my treatise on Cool Hand Luke by saying the reason why I think it is a religious movie and I equate it beyond all those references is, if you've ever read any Flannery O'Connor, and I love her short stories, she deals with religion in almost all of her stories. And there's a story called A Good Man is Hard to Find, which came out in 1953, about 10, 12 years before this. And in that story, there's a character called the Misfit, who is a guy who kills people. And there's a really interesting part where he says to the grandmother that he ends up killing in the story, "I never was a bad boy that I remember of," the Misfit said, "but somewheres along the line, I'd done something wrong and got sent to the penitentiary. I was buried alive." And you go back and you've got Luke in Cool Hand Luke saying, "I know I got no call to ask for much, but even so, you've got to admit you ain't dealt me no cards in a long time. It's beginning to look like you got things fixed so I can never win out. Inside, outside, all of them, rules and regulations and bosses, you made me like I am. Now just where am I supposed to fit in?" And I mean, literally, if you take the Misfit from Flannery O'Connor, that is who Luke, Paul Newman's character, is in Cool Hand Luke. So you can really go back and watch that movie completely from a religious perspective and in referencing the Bible, and it's a lot of fun. It's a great film.
You know, I don't think I ever considered the film that way. So now I have something else I need to add to my Pure Flix queue.
There you go.
That's really interesting. I had never thought about the film that way. My number one is a movie that is incredibly Catholic, surprising since I myself am an Episcopalian. And it's another movie I saw when I was in religion class and stuck with me. And I love this film. It's A Man for All Seasons from 1966.
Paul Scofield.
Paul Scofield, John Hurt, Orson Welles, Susanna York, and Robert Shaw giving his greatest film performance, bar none, and I include Jaws in that, as Henry VIII. It is a brilliant blowhard of a performance, and he absolutely commands the screen. It's worth seeing just for that, but the language in this film is astounding. I don't think I've ever seen a film before or since that loves language as much as this film does. Things like the Duke of Norfolk says, "Why can't you do as I did and come with us for fellowship?" And Sir Thomas More, Paul Scofield, says, "And when we die, and you are sent to heaven for doing your conscience, and I am sent to hell for not doing mine, will you come with me for fellowship?" And just, it's this incredibly like deep and profound and interesting language that you can just really sink your teeth into. I mean, the script was, I believe, won the Oscar. I know it was nominated. And just an incredibly brilliant and interesting film for that. And I, interestingly enough, it's also big with lawyers because it deals with this idea about what is the law and how do you obey the law, how do you follow the law. And it's just, there's so much going on in this film. I think you can watch it 2 or 3 times and get something new out of it every time.
I think that's a great choice. And my number one is also going classic here. I don't have much to say about it. I think it speaks for itself. It's The Seventh Seal. Bergman. You have Max von Sydow as this knight returning from the Crusades in the 14th century, who, of course, plays chess with the Grim Reaper. The Grim Reaper comes and says, "It's your time," and he wants to stave off death as much as possible, as long as possible, so he gets him to play chess and keeps trying to prolong the game so that he can avoid death. And you've got this film that is this meditation on mortality and search for meaning, which I think ultimately is the function of religion. That is why we turn to religion, probably. And nobody does that better than Bergman. I think that what makes it so much fun, too, is that there is humor in it. There is this dark Bergman comedy in it, the comedy of playing chess with the Grim Reaper, even though the film is so serious. And I love those shades to it. Seventh Seal is my number one choice.
Excellent.
And I briefly want to mention some honorable mentions. We didn't get to do our 6 through 10 because we're only doing one show this week. Three movies that I left off that were hard for me to leave off. The Mission, you've got Robert De Niro and Jeremy Irons, two of my favorite actors in the same film. Witness, another movie I love, dealing with the Amish and, and the allure, really, of that faith and their lifestyle that, that Harrison Ford comes to appreciate in that film is great. And also Dead Man Walking, I think, is a really interesting film. I think Tim Robbins, despite his political leanings, manages to be very fair in that film in showing both sides of the issue.
Sure.
It gives the parents and the people who want vengeance their time in the film, and you don't feel like he's hitting you over the head too much with his point of view. So those were my honorable mentions. Did you have some?
You know, I had a couple. Obviously, Star Wars has very spiritual overtones to them. And you could just have an entire, you know, thesis on the religious overtones and the mythological overtones of that film. The Sound of Music, which I really enjoy.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, there's nuns all over the place in that film, and there's just a profound religiosity in that film, a profound spirituality in terms of, you know, how do you stand up to evil in mm-hmm. some ways, and, you know, sometimes you just sing. and also, I thought about Malcolm X, actually.
I did too.
And yeah. and really kind of went back and forth as to whether or not to include that, a film that just really kind of talks about, again, the redemptive nature of religion
yeah.
And faith and how it kind of changes your life.
Could have been there on my list, too. That is our top five, and that is our show. Please send any feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net. Or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. Also on our blog, sign up for the Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast. Opening this weekend, Al Gore's global warming documentary, An Inconvenient Truth, in limited release, and the third and perhaps final installment of the X-Men franchise, X-Men The Last Stand, which Sam and I will review on next Wednesday's show. Sam will be back, and we'll be back to our two-show format next week. We'll also get into your top five performances feedback and our top five screen parents, tying in with Mother's and Father's Day,
sure.
but also X-Men 3. You've got a father developing this cure, so it ties in nicely with X-Men 3. Thanks to Keith Jenkins and the Moving Parts and Reverbose Records for today's music. Please check them out on the web at reverbose.com for Film Spotting. And Scott, I want to thank you once again for doing a fine job filling in for Sam.
Me.
I'm sure we'll have you back. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Scott Smith. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Sign up and swap the DVDs you have for the ones you really want at filmspotting.net, and also by Honda Fit. The all-new Honda Fit is small on the outside, yet roomy and versatile on the inside. A VTEC engine, anti-lock braking system, and front side and side curtain airbags are standard. And for added style, there's the Fit Sport Automatic with rear roofline spoiler and wheel-mounted paddle shifters. The Honda Fit is set and ready to go. Check it out at fit.honda.com.